You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. The overlap between California's homelessness crisis and its mental health crisis is visible on the streets of LA every day.
There will be people screaming, running up and down the street. We've had people knock on our door several times, this one woman in particular. And
earlier this year, Sarah Wesselcouch stood in her front yard in Silver Lake and spoke to KCRW reporter Anna Scott about homelessness in her neighborhood. And she says she feels helpless seeing people in distress. And most of her neighbors are in the same boat.
Everyone I've talked to feels this way. Very few people are like angry in the way that's like not empathetic to their situation. And there's clearly such a connection between the mental health of it all and what's going on, which also just feels so sad.
People have had it. They're exhausted.
That's Governor Gavin Newsom speaking to our public radio partners at KQED a couple of months ago about the feelings of people like Wesselcouch.
The most vexing and frustrating for all of us is you see people out on the streets and sidewalks self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions that clearly are struggling with psychotic disorders or schizophrenia spectrum. And not only do they seem helpless, but society seems helpless in terms of addressing their needs.
Newsom says he has a plan that'll help people with severe mental health or addiction disorders. It's called Care Court and would allow court-ordered treatment plans for people who fit those criteria. As the bill has started making its way through the legislature, however, opposition has grown. And even if it does become law, it won't be the silver bullet that it might sound like at first. KCRW's Anna Scott covers homelessness and housing, and she's here now to talk about all of that. Hi, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
The big picture, this does sound like it could do a lot to alleviate the homelessness crisis, especially here in L.A. But last time we spoke, you said that's not necessarily true. Why not?
Yeah, you know, it's easy to walk around, see people having behavioral issues on the streets and just think, well, if we could fix the mental health system or fix addiction, then we could fix homelessness, right? But for one thing, the Care Court would only be for people suffering from very severe disorders, and not just people experiencing homelessness, by the way. Supporters estimate that this system could serve between 7,000 and 12,000 people around the state.
7 to 12,000. I mean, that's a big number, obviously, but just a fraction of L.A. County's unhoused population, right? Which is at the last count, which was a couple of years ago, 66,000 people. So the idea is to help people who are right now among the hardest to help. Is that right?
Yes, the hardest to help people with very severe forms of these illnesses. This isn't something that's going to end homelessness, which remains at its core a socioeconomic crisis. But for a minority of people who are too sick to care for themselves and whose friends or family or even doctors don't have a lot of options for compelling them to get care, this could apply to them.
All right. So care, that's the word. And it's being called Care Court. Remind us how Care Court would work.
It's still really early, so it's just a general framework, but it's supposed to be something that is in between a three-day psych hold, say, and a full-on conservatorship where people just lose their legal right to make decisions. So people with qualifying illnesses, and we still don't know exactly how they're going to be diagnosed or who's going to be doing the diagnoses, but people who qualify could come under a court-mandated 1 or 2 year treatment plan. And the thinking is that the person ideally could get help without giving away their independence forever. There are a lot of holes in the mental health care system, the way things are now. Not everyone agrees, though, that this is the best way to fill those holes.
Well, let's talk about those people who don't agree. I mean, who are the opponents and what are they saying about Care Court?
The opposition has built up quite a bit since we last talked about this. We knew it was going to be controversial, and now we're seeing the ways in which that's true. Dozens of advocacy groups, including the ACLU and Disability Rights California, wrote a letter opposing this proposal. And in it, they argued that there are just some very basic questions that have not been answered yet. For example, they ask, how would this help with the shortage of housing and treatment options for people who need both of those things? Also, how would this avoid reinforcing systemic racial biases that already result in disproportionate numbers of Black and brown people unhoused and under court supervision? A lot of these same concerns came up during a hearing on the Care Court bill in Sacramento just a couple of weeks ago. One person who spoke is from Los Angeles County. Her name's Karis Myrick. She lives with a serious mental health disorder herself and also works in the mental health field helping others.
Courts have not been fair, safe, or a place of care for Black and brown people. When systems fail people, we compel the people to the very broken systems rather than creating systems that meet needs of all people in the least restrictive way possible.
During that same hearing, supporters also spoke out, many from personal experience as well. There was a father named Uday Kapoor who said that his son has schizoaffective disorder and lives in a residential care facility right now. But too often, people with serious conditions like his,
they end up on our streets, in prison, homeless, or dead.
He said the way that things are now, too many people have to be institutionalized or further traumatized just to get the help that they need.
No one should have to experience multiple involuntary hospitalizations, arrests, and jail time, or years of homelessness in order to access needed treatment.
It's a pretty powerful statement. I mean, this is still being debated, Anna, in the legislature. I mean, that means it's not even close to becoming law yet, right?
It's not yet. It is slowly working its way through the process. We should know by early June if it's going to pass the Senate floor and move on to the Assembly. If so, it's going to have to go through a bunch of hearings there. It might go back to the Senate. All of that would need to be done by the end of August. As the bill stands, its provisions would take effect on January 1st of next year, if all goes as planned, but a lot could happen. It could die before it ever gets that far. It could end up getting changed, and that could delay it. It could go into effect and then trigger a lawsuit that delays implementation. So we'll just have to see what happens.
We'll continue to track it. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness. Anna, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, for people suffering from mental illness who are already entangled in the criminal justice system, there's a pathway to get diverted from jail and into supportive housing. That's the role of the Office of Diversion and Reentry, or ODR. The LA County Board of Supervisors created that program back in 2015, and in the past several years, judging by different metrics, it has been successful. It offers several programs to those who are eligible. For example, folks who suffer from mental health issues can move into ODR housing and can access services and resources provided, like a case manager or nurses or social workers. Well, since its inception, the program has diverted nearly 4,000 people from jail. But it hasn't been able to accept a single new client in more than a year. Here to talk about it is ODR Medical Director, Dr. Kristen Ochoa. Doctor, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Emily Bell is the director of SSG Project 180, which is one of the providers working with ODR Housing. Emily, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Doctor, I want to start with you. The obvious question here is, why hasn't the program been able to accept any new clients lately?
Yes, actually, we have several programs, but the program that you're referring to, our largest program called ODR Housing, which is based in the criminal courts, is not taking any new clients because of funding issues.
Funding issues? Where does the funding come from? The state or the county?
Both, yes. Both. Primarily the county on this particular program.
So where did the funding go? Was it not promised at first? Is it a budget issue? How is that? I mean, obviously politics weigh into all of this, I'm sure. What happened?
Well, we had, fortunately, we've been able to fill the program for a few years now. And then we reached a cap of 2,200 active clients, at which point we weren't able to add new clients without further funding.
I mean, as issues go in L.A. County, I would presume that housing is sort of at the top of the list, right? Let's get people into housing. This is one area where you're trying to get people into housing, right?
Yeah, and it's not just people in housing. That simply, it's some of our, you know, most disabled, most vulnerable citizens of the county, you know, people who really have been chronically homeless for many years, people with serious mental disorders, many of whom have also serious physical disorders, who are chronically in and out of the justice system because they're homeless and have serious mental disorders. And, you know, it's a really vulnerable population that it's not easy to keep those folks in housing. They need a lot of treatment and supports to keep them there. And we've been able to figure it out and keep them housed. And we want to keep doing that service. So, yeah. I agree.
How does it work? How do you get the most vulnerable into housing through the ODR housing program?
We do it through the court system. So people are actively in jail, and we work with our partners, our judge partners, our, you know, defense lawyers and our prosecutors all together in a collaborative effort. The courtroom sort of looks like a clinic, and our doctors and social workers are actively seeing the clients in lockup while they have their hearings in court, and we're testifying, and we're all coming to the agreement that this person would be better served in a supportive housing program than, you know, for much more time in jail. Many of them are facing significant time in jail and or prison. These are not people who would have come out inevitably, and we're just kind of receiving them at the back end. These are people that were very deliberately, consciously treating and trying to get through a hearing process so that they can be court ordered to us.
So I would imagine if the choice, okay, so instead of going to jail, we provide you this housing, especially for the most vulnerable. I mean, if that person had gone to jail afterward, I mean, in a former system, before this ODR housing system took place, they would wind up on the streets. Is that correct?
You're right. Like at the end of the road, after they were done doing their time, yes, often, unfortunately, that is the most common outcome, is that they would end up again with no services. And then, not surprisingly, be very likely to then return to our emergency rooms, return to our inpatient hospital units in the county, return to our jails. That's a pretty common path, and we're just happy to interrupt it with the supportive housing that we offer.
Why do you think the program has been hailed as such a success?
Oh, gosh. We have amazing providers, and we have an amazing team that takes care of our folks no matter what, that gives people chances because that's what they need and deserve over and over again. It's pretty simple when it gets down to it, you know, providing what you and I need to, just food and shelter and love and
the basics
and
yeah.
The feeling of community. It's really pretty simple. And we have providers that don't give up on people, and our team doesn't give up on people. And we really have, even the justice partners, the judges and the lawyers are in that same boat. We've kind of created something that works, and we're riding that wave as far as we can.
Emily, let me bring you into the conversation, talk more about SSG Project 180. This is one of the providers working with ODR. What exactly does Project 180 provide?
For the ODR housing program, we have an intensive case management program that we provide. So it's an interdisciplinary team of case managers, substance abuse counselors, therapists, psychiatrists, who go and see the clients in the field, mostly at these housing sites, and provide, you know, really intensive case management and treatment services to those clients.
So this isn't housing placement. This is after they're placed into housing. Those folks
Correct.
Get the treatment they need through SSG Project 180. How many patients are you guys overseeing over there?
You know, I think in ODR housing, we have upwards of 550.
And they do the work. You say they go to the clients, right? They go to their housing. They go to where they are.
Yeah, we found that, you know, if you expect folks to come to you, it's just more inconvenient for them. So it's better for us to go to them where they are, make it convenient. And we take them places, take them to their appointments, take them for all the things that they need to take care of and see them in their environment.
Y'all have been working with ODR since the beginning, right? Since its inception.
Correct.
What were those early days like? I mean, what's changed even into today in terms of how the providers work with the clients and how they have worked with the clients since the beginning?
Yeah, at the beginning, I remember the initial plan for, the number of clients that we were going to serve. I think it like doubled at least. There was so much demand for the service in the justice system that what I recall is that ODR was like doubling and tripling what they had committed to really quickly. Because the demand was so high and the population was really high need. And so what I appreciated about working with ODR is that they were nimble in terms of changing the model, adjusting the ratio of case manager, for example, to make it a little bit lower, adding some clinical support staff. So it was exciting, and you know, really nice to see that the funder and the partner was able to make changes pretty quickly to make it succeed.
Doctor, do you feel like the program has changed in scope beyond what it was originally set up to do?
I do. We definitely didn't expect to be this big in the beginning or have this much demand or success. In some ways, this demand it's wonderful, but it's also sad, right? There's, we think, you know, more than half, you know, the RAND study said 61% of the jail mental health population could be diverted out into services like this if they existed. And, you know, what started as a program where we were just seeing people post conviction. So they would you know, be convicted and then receive terms and conditions of their probation to come to our services. Now we're doing what's called mental health diversion, where under a penal code, they can receive diversion and then those charges actually go away. So we've really kind of expanded our capabilities to be able to take on a lot more people in different types of cases. Felony cases as well, you know, that are sometimes serious felonies where people would not have sort of come out of the justice system so readily. And those people have been really successful in the community in a really structured setting. And so it just has provided everyone with an opportunity to make a big societal change, which is not have those people be incarcerated, but actually have them be out in a really supportive environment.
But again, the funds have dried up. This isn't happening anymore. It's diversion into at least ODR housing, right? What do you guys do from now?
Well, we continue to work with the 2,200 people that we have. Obviously, we're, you know, continuing to provide services for our existing clients, and that means, you know, permanent supportive housing. So we really see this as the true answer for this population, that they receive ongoing services. So we're able to provide those very thankfully for the 2,200. And we're just hoping that we get the opportunity to expand, because this is really this is the sickest of the sick population, vulnerable populations in Los Angeles County. And we really want to keep doing the work. We figured it out. We have a great team and great partners, and we want to keep going.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on and talking to us today. Dr. Christian Ochoa, Medical Director of ODR, and Emily Bell, the Director of SSG Project 180. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Straight ahead, an old crime, a newer law. The cases of two people convicted of murder get a second look decades later in OC. All over Greater LA, you're listening to KCRW. Onward now with Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A 30-year-old murder conviction overturned in Orange County. Just last week, a judge resentenced two men convicted of second-degree murder after they had already served nearly 30 years in prison. Gustavo Arellano is columnist for the LA Times, a regular, of course, here on GLA, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Hola to you. A 17-year-old San Clemente boy named Steve Woods died in October of 1993. What was the situation? What happened there?
So it was late Friday night. There was a group of Latino teens who got an altercation with a group of other teens. And so the other teens, they go into their cars. They start trying to get out of the parking lot of Calafia State Beach down in San Clemente. The Latino teens thought that the other teens were trying to run them over. So they start throwing things out of a pickup truck of the dad of one of those Latino teens. So they throw dirt clods. They throw buckets. They throw a paint roller. Well, that paint roller somehow crashes through the window and penetrates the skull of Stephen Woods, who dies a couple of days later.
The two men whose murder convictions have been overturned, these men are Rogelio Vasquez Solis and Saul Penuelas, right? How were they involved in this specifically?
So they were there. They were there. They admitted to being there. Rogelio admitted to throwing a dirt clod. Again, he said that he felt that his life was in danger. You have these cars barreling down towards where you're at, swerving in your direction at late at night. And this is highly racialized Orange County, early 1990s. Yeah, you're going to be throwing things to try to save your life. And, and it's interesting because when the case first came out, when the crime first came out, the sheriff's department themselves, they said this was a fluke. This was not premeditated. There's nothing. But since it was early 1990s, Orange County, you get this big uproar, and somehow a fluke, a freak accident turns into a murder case that ends up galvanizing the anti-immigrant movement across California.
I mean, freakish for sure with the paint roller. But I mean, again, getting back to the clod of dirt, how does someone who's thrown a clod of dirt get convicted of second degree murder?
Again, this is Orange County, early 1990s. Imagine you have a 17-year-old white kid, teenager, being killed by a group of Latinos in that era. Of course, the teens stood no chance. Mike Davis, the legendary, rabble rouser of history, later on covered it for The Nation and called it a legal lynching in Orange County. So all of those teens, even though there was one guy admitted, I was the one who threw the paint roller, he got out of prison. Geez, I think he only spent 10 years. But Rogelio and the other gentleman, Saul, they were the ones who spent all that time in prison for, again, they did not kill Stephen Woods. Someone else did. Even the prosecutors said that, but they said because those teens were there, they were all accessories to murder.
Penuelas had already been paroled. Solis is still in prison. He was 17 at the time of Wood's death. Even so, he was tried as an adult. His sentence was 15 years to life. Why has he been there for 30 years in prison for throwing dirt at a truck? I mean, surely he would have been paroled by now, right?
This is Orange County, Steve. And my former OC
but
Weekly 30 managing...
years for a clod of dirt?
Yeah. No, this is Orange County. My former OC Weekly managing editor, Nick Scow, did a deep dive into this case a couple of months ago for the Red Canary Collective online. And he talked about the importance of this murder case. What happened was that the anti-immigrant camp in California used Stephen Woods' killing as a pretext to try to pass Proposition 187. In fact, you had a lot of these rallies for years afterwards. They had the x-ray, this grisly x-ray of the paint rod going through Stephen Woods' head with the legend, murdered by an illegal alien. The mom, Kathy Woods, of Stephen Woods, she became a very outspoken opponent of any, of illegal immigration for years, to the point where in 2016 at a rally in Phoenix, Donald Trump brought her on stage and she said that what they did to the cars that night when her son was killed was akin to Beirut. So it was, and every time there was a parole hearing, Kathy Woods would show up and say, Rogelio does not deserve to be freed. And so he was never freed until it took a judge to do this.
All right. Well, then what happened then? What is it that the judge did? Why did it trigger the judge to finally give a second look at the two men's murder conviction?
It shows how many laws are being passed in California. Apparently, there's a law now that says that you cannot be convicted of a murder if you were not, if you didn't commit the actual murder. In other words, if you were accessory, you were there, you cannot be convicted of murder charges. Sure, you could still be convicted of whatever other crimes pertain to you. But she said because of that, Rogelio and Saul, they did not, their sentences were overturned. She said, you still did a crime, but because you've already been in prison for almost 30 years, now you get to go free.
What's next for them, for Solis and Penuelas?
I got to figure out. I had planned to write, Rogelio was up for parole in June, so I planned to do a column about it for the LA Times. Now this kind of throws everything into a loop, so I need to get in contact with the family. We had, at the OC Weekly, 5 years ago, we wanted to do something on this, and we were not able to do anything until Nick finally did this. So we're still trying to figure out how this happened and why on a Friday, all of this happened. But yeah, there you go. Rogelio's free now.
Well, very quickly, did prosecutors in OC go along or did they push back?
It's Todd Spitzer's office. Of course, they're always going to push back. And so it remains to be seen. Maybe they'll still appeal this. This is Orange County, after all.
All right. Gustavo Arellano, LA Times columnist, of course, a regular here at Greater LA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a special restaurant in Silver Lake celebrates decades in business and an upstairs-downstairs entertainment and business model. Casita del Campo turns 60. That is tomorrow. on Greater LA. We're a little younger, so we could use your ears and eyes when you check out our website at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share what's on your mind. Hey, how about a story idea? Subscribe to the podcast, too. We'd love to hear from you at kcrw.com/GLA. And by the way, you can get your podcast, the GLA podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Ludman, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped assemble this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis, honored by your presence. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.